Our first case for argument this morning is United States against Brown. Mr. Stanton.
May it please the court, counsel. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Bill Stanton. I represent the appellant Henry Brown in this matter. This case is before this court after Mr. Brown was convicted by a jury of a drug trafficking conspiracy and sentenced to life in prison. He raises several issues on appeal. First and foremost of those is that illegal GPS, warrantless GPS monitoring of Mr. Brown in this case violated his constitutional rights. We submit that the appropriate standard of review in this case is harmless error. At the time of Mr. Brown's trial, this
How
court...
How was this issue raised in the district court?
Mr. Brown... At the time of his trial, this court's decision in Garcia.
Issues about the admissibility of evidence, motions to suppress, have to be raised before trial. By the time of trial, it's too late.
Well, Mr. Brown did
raise before trial on a motion to suppress?
Mr. Brown did raise it in a motion to suppress the search warrant at 1441 Morris Avenue in Berkeley, Illinois. And he incorporated that the information that was obtained, that was included in the affidavit for search warrant.
Counsel, could you answer my question? Was there a motion to suppress made before trial?
There was a motion to suppress the search warrant, yes.
All right. And was this argument urged in support of that motion?
Primarily no, but was it included? Yes. At the time of this trial, this court had decided Garcia in February of 2007. Mr. Brown's trial was not until February of 2009. Obviously, the Supreme Court's decision in Jones came down in 2012, making this issue subject to harmless error review under Federal Rule of Appellate Procedure 52A. Even if this court
could be subject to harmless error review, if it was not raised in the district court.
Well, Judge, a supervening decision abrogated established precedent, and the Supreme Court in Fahey took that into account, and in Fahey, I believe the case of Matt versus Ohio had been decided while the case was on appeal, and the Fahey court subjected the case to harmless error review. Even if this court
You're thinking of this 1963 decision of the Supreme Court, the one you relied on in your reply brief?
Correct.
You know that was based on Fay against Noya, and you know Fay has been overruled. What do you say about Rule 12E, Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 12E?
Judge, even if this court were to apply plain error, we think plain error would be...
Counsel, look, I wish you would answer my questions. What do you say about Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 12E specifically?
We did not address that in the brief.
I know you didn't address it in the brief. It was raised by the government. Rule 12E says that an issue that could be raised before trial, if it's not raised before trial, is waived.
And it's our position that it couldn't be raised before trial based...
Of course it could be raised before trial. Your position is that if you had raised it before trial, you were likely to lose. That's different from it couldn't be raised before trial.
Even if this court were to apply plain error...
No, look. The language of Rule 12E is waived, not forfeited.
Well, Mr. Brown doesn't think that he was derelict in not making this objection before the trial court.
We have a rule. We don't just ignore the rules. You may wish that the rule weren't there or that the word was something other than waived, but I don't see how ignoring it is going to make it go away.
Well, Your Honor, in his motion to suppress the search warrant, he included information that obviously was obtained as a result of this GPS monitoring. So I believe the court, the Katzen court, and the court in Commonwealth versus Connolly, which is, of course, persuasive authority, saw that the issue was not waived.
And how do you deal with the rule which says it is waived?
We think that by filing the motion to suppress the challenge the evidence from the search warrant that included information from the GPS, that we didn't waive this issue. government suggests that Mr. Brown has no standing in this case, and I think it's without question that he had actual and lawful possession of this Jeep from August 2nd, 2006 up until August 5th of 2006. He drove the Jeep with the permission of the owner, and he was the target of the law enforcement monitoring of the GPS unit. As such, he has a legitimate and reasonable expectation of privacy.
Was the Supreme Court case based on trespass?
The Jones case was based on trespass. They reserved the issue of reasonable expectation of privacy for later ruling. The recent decision 2 weeks ago by the Third District in Katzen specifically dealt
with... Third Circuit, you mean?
Third Circuit in Katzen dealt with the reasonable expectation of privacy, decided that warrantless GPS usage was improper, that the good faith exception did not apply. And I think that decision in Katzen was should be followed by this court. It's clear that Mr. Brown suffered harm in this case.
Why?
Without the GPS device, the government would not have learned a number of things that allowed it to get evidence against Mr. Brown. Specifically, the government would not have known of the 1441 Morris Avenue address.
Well, he picked up a car that had a GPS in it. He picked up the car which had the GPS in it.
Correct.
What if the owner had actually had his own GPS in it?
Well, that's not the case here.
No, I know it's not the case here. I said, what if he had had a GPS and the police used his GPS?
I think the fact that police monitored GPS without Mr. Brown's knowledge, without his consent, was essentially the constable and the stagecoach analogy that prior courts have alluded to.
Well, banks put GPS devices in bait packets from time to time. I've seen cases like that. Would your argument apply to that as well if the FBI or someone started tracking that GPS once the bait was out of the bank?
I think that's different because in that case, a crime had already taken place, where in this case the GPS was used to...
Well, the crime's underway. He's negotiating with this informant about the obtaining, what was it, 10 kilograms of cocaine and
correct.
So forth. It's in progress.
I think that the bank analogy, the robbery has already taken place, and then they're searching for a person who just robbed a bank, not somebody who's considering committing a crime.
It's hard for me to see how that's different.
When Mr. Brown took possession of the Jeep, there was nothing criminal inside that Jeep. When the bank robber takes possession of the bag with the device in it, he has ill-gotten gains.
Why did he take the Jeep if there wasn't this plan underway to distribute cocaine to him, to the informant?
Well, I think one of the theories of the defense at trial was that there was going to be some sort of documents that would be exchanged, that false identification card, something of that nature. I mean, the 10 kilograms of cocaine could have as easily fit into a Jeep as they could have the Mercury Marauder that Mr. Arms took possession of. Obviously, a warrantless search is presumed to be unreasonable, and the fact in this case is that the government and Mr. Arms controlled the pace of this transaction. So there was ample time for government agents to secure a warrant in this case. I believe the first contact happened at the end of July, July 28th, I believe, and the exchange of the vehicle didn't happen until 5 days later. There was no showing why government agents could not have gone before a detached and neutral magistrate in those intervening 5 days, presented the facts that were in their possession, and secured a search warrant.
If the informant had, instead of turning the car over to Brown, driven him around, had been his chauffeur for all of these movements and so forth, would your argument still apply?
I don't believe so, because the informant consented to the GPS being placed within his Jeep. Mr. Brown did not consent to that at the time he took possession. He had no knowledge of that, and I think the argument would be completely different.
What's that got to do with the expectation of privacy, though?
Well, the expectation of privacy is when you borrow a vehicle from someone, you're the lawful possessor of the vehicle.
So if you're being chauffeured rather than taking the car yourself, there's difference between your expectations?
Absolutely. I think if you have sole possession of a vehicle for a period of several days, your expectation of privacy is different than if someone is driving around in their vehicle. They still have control of that vehicle, the ability to exclude others from that vehicle. As far as the exclusionary rule in this case, I think the exclusionary rule is the traditional remedy for an illegal search, and that applies according to Davis and according to this court. In Martin, where the law regarding a search is unsettled and the precedent must be binding and unequivocal. As of August 2006, there was no binding precedent in this circuit. There was no Supreme Court decisions that spoke to GPS monitoring until 2012. And the exclusionary rule in this case would serve to deter future Fourth Amendment violations. It would be urging officers to err on the side of constitutionality prior to conducting a search. Detective Baker in this case essentially had two choices. He could have got a search warrant at the outset, or he could have gambled, rolled the dice with the sanction that the evidence that he obtained would be suppressed if the circuit court did not agree with his actions. The court in Katzen, that's exactly what they did. The same circuit in the Ortiz case did that, and the Kentucky District Court in Lee did that. And it's important to note that in the Katzen and the Lee cases, that was monitoring of shorter term that even occurred here. Those were 3 days of monitoring that the courts in those cases found to be long term. And the reason for that is because GPS devices are different from the beepers in kind, not degree. GPS devices monitor you for 24 hours a day, minute by minute, continuously. They're powerful, they're very precise, and they don't require any sort of visual surveillance. So this is a continuous search that's going on over a course of several days, and it replaced the physical abilities of police officers rather than enhance them.
Has replaced the physical ability of police officers? You mean after GPS they can no longer see?
After GPS they can sit in an office in Milwaukee 90 miles away from where
right,
the GPS...
Right, made it easier than tailing a car. I just don't understand the concept of replacing their physical ability. You get the picture of this Borg-like development in which their eyes are removed and GPS units are inserted.
With the beeper cases, the physical surveillance had to be conducted in combination with the beepers. Beepers were transmitting a radio signal that only carried a short distance. The officers that were tailing the suspect container or vehicle, whatever the case may be, had to be within close proximity in order to pick up that signal. In this case, Mr. Brown takes a Jeep from Kenosha, drives it to the west side of Chicago, drives it to Berkeley, Illinois. 90 miles away up in Milwaukee, Detective Baker is sitting in his office looking at a laptop and knows exactly with pretty precise degree where Mr. Brown is located, where that Jeep is located. So this was long-term monitoring. It was wholesale surveillance, and the intent of the investigating agents in this case was to monitor Henry Brown as long as possible or as long as necessary. Now, I think the agent's testimony in this case was that the device had a battery life of 3 to 4 days. We don't know, based on the facts of this case, whether they had intended to replace that device had it run out of juice. But it's clear that the vehicle, when it was parked at 1441 Morris Avenue in Berkeley, Illinois, for a period of days, could not hide from these 24 satellites that are hovering over it. Even on private property, the GPS device...
Not how GPS works, by the way. The unit receives satellite transmissions. It doesn't broadcast anything to the satellites. The unit then has a radio that broadcasts locally to the police receiver.
Right, I just said it couldn't hide from it. As far as the search warrant in this case that was conducted at 1441 Morris Avenue without the GPS information included in that affidavit for search warrant, it would have lacked probable cause. The only information that was left was one 20-month-old marijuana transaction that took place at that address, and a detached and neutral magistrate would not have found that to be probable cause. The information from the GPS tainted the search warrant both at 1441 and at 615. You see I entered my time for rebuttal. Unless you have any further questions, I'll sit down.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Stanton.
Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel, good morning. My name is Jonathan Koenig. I appear on behalf of the United States. And I'd like to begin by addressing Judge Easterbrook's questions about the standard of review. The defendant did not challenge the use of GPS technology as a constitutional violation in his motion to suppress. He just said in the course of his argument, we don't know something. We don't know. There are a lot of things we don't know in this case, and one of the reasons is they couldn't be fleshed out in an evidentiary hearing geared towards the use of GPS technology. That said, my reading of ACOX, and it may be wrong, is that at least on the facts of this case, which are sort of unusual, there was good cause under Rule 12 for not raising such a challenge. That only gets into plain error, in my view. Perhaps that's too generous. If the Jones arguments are completely waived, that suits me down to the ground. But my reading of the law is that what we have here is a plain error standard of review. And it becomes significant at several points in the analysis. For example, my argument about inevitable discovery, the backup plan that the agents had for this controlled delivery, that too would have been much more fleshed out had there been an opportunity to do so in the district court. So it's really only fair to the government that these issues around Jones be evaluated under a plain error standard, which, of course, the third and fourth prongs require that the supposed violation affects substantial rights and call into question the fairness and integrity of the proceedings. On Jones, I'd also like to dispel the notion that there's a poisonous tree growing in this case, a poisonous GPS tree. The use of GPS technology, I can understand why my opponent has relied on Jones, which was decided while this case was pending on appeal. But really, that technology didn't have a lot to do with the arrest of Troy Lewis, the search of 1441 Morris, or ultimately Mr. Brown's conviction at trial. Beginning with the arrest of Troy Lewis, the guy who was actually in the car when it was pulled over. The device had failed before he was pulled over, and on the basis of information from Troy Lewis related to Kevin Arms and then ultimately to Detective Baker, law enforcement had a team of people in place who were looking for this Jeep in Racine. And as I've alluded to before, yet another reason the arrest of Troy Lewis can't really be said to depend on GPS technology is that there was this backup plan, which Detective Baker talks about on page 139 of the transcript. I call it a controlled delivery for a reason. There was a plan in place that included both the Racine officers surveilling the highway and this backup plan to meet Troy Lewis in Milwaukee. As for the search of 1441, in order to buy the poisonous tree argument, you have to agree that GPS led to the arrest of Troy Lewis, which we don't. Marquita Lewis was Troy's passenger in the vehicle when it was pulled over. She gave the address of 1441. Kevin Arms was able to identify that as an address that he had been to in the past. And the challenge to the search warrant in the district court was based on staleness. And the reason that the warrant wasn't stale is, firstly, that it was a document warrant. So the objective wasn't to find drugs necessarily, although the agents did find drugs, including some packaging with Mr. Brown's fingerprints on it. But they also had DMV records, which showed 1441 Morris as a current address for Mr. Brown. So the tree, the poisonous tree, is not branching out and yielding fruit in that way either. And I think the court can resolve the case on that basis. It doesn't necessarily need to reach the good faith exception to the exclusionary rule. If it does, I strongly urge the court to reconsider some of the things that it said in Martin. And I do so because the purpose of the exclusionary rule is not to retroactively apply Fourth Amendment decisions. It's to deter police misconduct, conduct that the Supreme Court has said has to be reckless, deliberate, or grossly negligent. That language comes from the majority opinion in Davis, by the way. And the Supreme Court has said on many occasions the sole purpose of the exclusionary rule is deterrence. I don't see how deterrence is achieved in this particular case where in 2006, the summer of 2006, there was no pertinent law in our circuit or any other circuit, and the only precedent that was kicking around was the Beeper, were the Beeper cases. You can distinguish them on the basis that the technology was different, but they certainly didn't suggest to anyone that Jones, especially the majority opinion in Jones, would come along and turn out the way it did.
Let me back you up a little bit to the stop of Troy Lewis.
Yes.
The highway, it was a highway where that stop was made, is that right? Is that the principal highway that one would travel from Chicago to the Milwaukee area?
Yes, Your Honor. It's I-94 was the route he was taking. The cross street was Highway C.
And the stop was made by the Racine Sheriff's County Sheriff's Department?
That's correct.
And did they have GPS tracking ability at the time they made the stop? And were they tracking that Jeep?
I don't believe so. The record certainly doesn't reflect that at all. The only GPS device that's mentioned anywhere in the record was with Detective Baker, and he was at a point further south, turn off or something, further south from where the Racine deputies were. And I believe the purpose of having the Racine people execute the stop was not to tip his hand that there was a federal investigation, that this was part of a federal investigation. But that doesn't matter.
All right.
To answer your question, the record doesn't indicate anywhere that there was a second GPS device.
Thank you.
Are there any questions about GPS before I briefly address the evidentiary?
Was there any discussion about, the idea of, was that the plan to begin with? No trespass, permission to put the GPS in and transfer the car to Summers?
I'm quite sure that the agents in this case were not anticipating the majority decision in Jones, but maybe they may well have been aware of Knotts and Cairo, which I think are analogous. If I recall, those cases involved parcels or bundles or something in which a beeper had been placed before it came into the possession of the bad guy. On the business records certification challenge, I would urge the court to reaffirm its holding in Ellis. I don't see that Melendez-Diaz.
Why was this analysis? Business record certification admitted at trial?
It shouldn't have been, Your Honor. My understanding is that it's...
Indeed not. Well, isn't that a problem? We have a kind of evidence that under Rule 103 is supposed to be used exclusively by the judge before trial to determine whether evidence is admissible. Right? Rule 103 says plainly that this is for the judge only. Instead, it's exhibited to the jury, and the prosecutor makes arguments based on this evidence that the jury should never have heard. Don't you think we got a problem? I mean, forget about the confrontation clause. This is not what's supposed to happen, completely independent of the confrontation clause.
I would agree with you, Your Honor. I'm not going to fight you on that.
Why was it admitted? Why was the prosecutor making arguments based on this stuff that the jury should never have heard?
Well, I think the arguments, Your Honor, were more on the basis of the underlying document, the business, the receipt itself, as opposed to the certification. There wasn't certainly anything prejudicial in the certification itself.
No, it may be harmless in the end, but I'd
like to get to that in a minute, but I want to be sure I answer your question first.
Followed by why this egregiously, this obviously inadmissible document is admitted and used.
Well, I can't defend it, Your Honor, and I won't. But I would like to talk a little bit about harmless error since you've given me an opening to do so. There's in addition to the overall strength of our case, I think there's some specific pieces of evidence that make the admission of the Rimland documents harmless. One, a business card and a brochure for Mr. Rimland's law office were found in Mr. Brown's residence. They were admitted without objection. Troy Lewis testified that someone else paid his attorney. It came into evidence that Brown paid his bail. And lastly, of course, there's Steve Brown's testimony, the so-called jailhouse snitch who was incarcerated with Mr. Brown and says Mr. Brown related to him his concerns about having paid for Troy Lewis's attorney. So I would argue, in light of all those things, Your Honor, that neither the certificate nor the underlying receipt were harmful in this particular case. I can address either the limitations on cross-examination or the flight issue if you would like me to do so. It seems to me the judge's decision to limit inquiry about a conviction in another jurisdiction from 10 years prior was a perfectly acceptable exercise of discretion.
Could you touch on the flight issue just briefly?
Yes, sir.
The flight issue just briefly?
Yes. Well, as you know, cases like Russell express a concern about sort of free-floating flight evidence, especially if there's a big time interval between the criminal conduct and the flight. But then there's a whole bunch of cases that come after Russell, or at least a handful, that say, yes, but if there's something in the record that suggests the defendant, that's more recent, that suggests the defendant knew he was wanted, then we don't have a problem making the inferences that are set forth in Russell. Here, we do have that information. We have Mr. Brown's brother is at the scene of the 1441 Morris search warrant execution. His lawyer calls and is told there's a warrant outstanding for him. And then we have this high-speed chase through a residential neighborhood that follows. And, by the way, in Randy Brown's car, the same brother who was at 1441 when the search warrant was executed. So I think those things should allay any concern about the 4 or 5 month interval between the apprehension of Mr. Lewis on I-94 and Mr. Brown's flight from the police.
Thank you.
Is there any further questions? I would ask you to affirm. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any counsel? Anything further, Mr. Stanton?
Yes.
I'd like to address this affidavit of Attorney Jack Rimland because I do believe Mr. Brown was caused harm by the introduction of that. The government referenced this affidavit in conjunction with the receipt in opening and closing throughout trial. And Melendez-Diaz told us that government can't prove aspects of its case through ex parte affidavits. Now, this affidavit was read in its entirety into the record at trial. The jury got to hear.
How was the affidavit harmful, independent of the evidence being authenticated?
Because what the affidavit did essentially said that the receipt was kept in the course of business and that it was made at the time that the money was received. So it enhanced the reliability.
Those were the authentication details, and what should have happened was that the judge should have heard this, deemed the record authenticated, and admitted it independent of, without telling the jury about this affidavit.
Right.
But the sting seems to be in the authenticated record, not in the affidavit authenticating it.
Well, if the affidavit was like the one historical exception where it's a clerk's office authentication saying that this is an official record, maybe that would be the case. But here, the affidavit actually enhanced and bolstered the reliability of this receipt. The receipt showed a conspiratorial relationship between Troy Lewis and Henry Brown, and the affidavit did more than certify the correctness. It spoke to how that receipt was made in a manner that made the receipt more reliable. Based on that, we think that Mr. Brown certainly was harmed by the introduction of this affidavit. To respond to a couple of counsel's arguments, inevitable discovery, he speaks to Detective Baker's plan to formulate a additional plan if the ruse traffic stop in Racine did not occur. And the details of that plan, as Detective Baker testified to, had not been formulated at the time this Jeep was stopped. Essentially, Detective Baker planned to make a plan if his initial stop using the GPS surveillance and the ruse that the Racine County deputies were to discover probable cause on this Jeep. If that didn't work, then he was going to have to figure out something else. That's not inevitable discovery. As it relates to the poisonous tree, they talk about this. The government talks about the search of 1441 Morris Avenue in Berkeley, that Kevin Arms identified that address. Well, Kevin Arms identified that address not during the course of the investigation prior to Troy Lewis's arrest, not at any time up until November of 2006, right before that search warrant was executed, when government agents drove him to that address, pointed at the house, and said, "Kevin, do you recognize that address?" "Oh, yeah, I think almost 2 years ago I might have had a marijuana transaction there with Henry Brown." So it's not as if Mr. Arms volunteered that address or gave it to them independent of them learning it through the GPS device. This arrest of Troy Lewis, Your Honor, asked if the GPS was being monitored at the time that the Jeep was pulled over. The battery on the GPS went out about 20 miles south of where the Jeep was pulled over. I believe the record shows that the battery went out in Gurnee, Illinois. Detective Baker was in contact with those Racine sheriffs, telling them where the Jeep was, that it would, what time it would be passing through the area where they were at.
What part of the record establishes this?
Detective Baker's testimony on direct examination. If you want the exact site, I could follow up with that.
We'll take a look at it.
And I see that my time is up. If there's any other questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Thank you, Mr. Stanton. The
case
is taken under advisement.
Appreciate it.